The story that you're listening to began as a feature in the print edition of The Atlantic. Although in this episode and subsequent episodes, you'll be hearing several details that have never before been reported. If you're not a subscriber to our print magazine, you're missing out. And Radio Atlantic listeners get a special 15% discount on subscriptions. Just go to theatlantic.com/radiosubscribe. Hello, Barbara.
Hello, Matt.
Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And now we're joined by Jeff. Hello, Jeff.
Hi, Matt.
And Alex over in New York. Hi, Alex.
Hi, guys.
So, quite a story.
Could I do a step back question? Let's go all the way back, Barb. This is an amazing story, and you tell it amazingly well. I want to know what feelings you're left with after doing this remarkable story, not only about your protagonist, but about the system.
Yeah, it feels a little Kafka-esque. Now, we have to be really sure. I have to state this clearly. I am not saying that Ben Spencer is innocent. We do not have, you know, absolute proof of that, so I just want to get that out there. And yet, if he is innocent, it seems like the system is really set up to keep an innocent man in prison. And, you know, I think about the fact that he has had all of these things done for him. Centurion Ministries investigated the case for 4 years. A lawyer was hired and got the case before a judge who then decided that he deserved a new trial based on actual innocence. We've investigated this. NPR did a story. All of this stuff has happened. And yet it could be that at the end of the line, you know, the system will keep him in prison. And so, for me, it's a little bit of a discouraging outcome.
Barbara, let me ask you the question that I think the typical listener wants to know from you, who's been so deep in this. What do you think? I recognize that journalistically you're not going to issue your own exoneration, but what do you actually think happened?
So, I wake up at night thinking about this because I go, oh, my gosh. I break out in a cold sweat and I go, oh, my gosh, what if I'm wrong? What if he is actually guilty and that DNA shows that, right? I think about that. And then I add up everything and I look at the witnesses who have recanted, the witnesses that have come forward that were never testified in the trial, the judge that says he's innocent, the two people that say their friend confessed to this. And I go, okay, the math adds up. I think he's innocent.
Barb, you're waking up in a cold sweat at night. What about the people who have recanted their testimony or come out and said, you know, what I said wasn't true, who effectively put this man in jail? What has the emotional tenor of those conversations been like?
Right. That's been really interesting. Of course, one of the people won't speak to me. That's Gladys Oliver. She's kind of the state's star witness. But the other two I've talked to have been really, really interesting. So I talked to the jailhouse informant who was the only one to connect Ben Spencer to the actual assault of Jeffrey Young. And he told me, no, you know what? Ben Spencer really never told me that. I don't think Ben Spencer is guilty at all. And then he said, so what's happened to Ben? And I said, well, he's in prison. He's in prison for life. And there was this really long silence. And then I said, how does that make you feel? And there's a long silence. And then he goes, like shit. Mm-hmm. And then Daryl Parker talked to Jimmy Cotton right after he had recanted and said that Gladys Oliver orchestrated the whole thing. And after that, Jimmy Cotton said to Daryl Parker, who was the investigator, he said, so do you know Spencer's family? And Daryl Parker said, yes, I do. And he said, would you tell them that I am so sorry that I've done this to him?
Wow.
One of the themes that you highlighted in the story, Barb, that really sticks with me is the way that West Dallas, this predominantly black part of Dallas, was read superficially in some ways by the folks outside it. So Jeffrey Young lived and worked in another part of the city. But most of the folks who've been at the center of this story, most of the witnesses in his trial, the two friends of Michael Hubbard who pointed the finger at him, most of them come from West Dallas. And in this milieu, they drew all sorts of distinctions about themselves and their social circles that others, that the outsiders in this story, did not draw. We heard a reference by a police officer to one of the alibi witnesses for Ben Spencer that the jury didn't hear from, Sandra Brackens. We heard them refer to her as a crack whore.
Right.
And then we hear from her on tape, and she's just this, you know, this sweet, haunted, eloquent person. We hear a lot of folks draw a distinction between Ben Spencer, who, like, had gotten in trouble with the cops once or twice for joyriding.
Right.
But had never been convicted of a violent crime.
Right.
And Michael Hubbard, who actually had not only dabbled in robbery with his friend, but also had been convicted years later for these brutal assaults. And I'm curious about now, as you've gone back and reported this story, has the racial picture within Dallas, the way that, for example, the police officers see this part of the city, has that changed?
Yeah, it has changed, but it took a long time to do it. I mean, we know that Dallas is known for community policing. David Brown, the police chief, was highly respected. So things have changed. But let's just, if we can, go back to that era, because it took a long time for it to change. So I don't know if you remember the movie A Thin Blue Line, the documentary.
Morris.
Right, exactly. That was Dallas in the 1970s. And in that case, you had it was in this case a white man, poor white man, who was convicted, wrongly convicted of murdering a policeman. What was interesting about that and what the movie showed is that there was this culture, this attitude of the police and the prosecutors in Dallas in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. Why those four decades? Because there was a DA named Henry Wade, and he basically was DA for almost four decades. And under him, the ethos was solve a crime very quickly and get as long a sentence as you possibly can. So in some cases, the sentences were more than 1,000 years, right? And so that was the ethos back then. And when you look back, now we can look back at that time. And what we see is that there are a lot of exonerations from people in that era. So far, 17 exonerations. And there's got to be more, because a lot of the people convicted in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s are dead or on parole or something. They're not worth reinvestigating. So it's a lot of people who've been exonerated from that era. And that was the era of Ben Spencer.
How did race play into that era, to the Wade era?
So most of the cops were not black. And this was at the height of the crack epidemic when mm-hmm. Ben Spencer was arrested. And so there was this sense, and I've got this from people who are historians of the city, that kind of any minority will do. If that black person didn't do this crime, he did this crime. And so you might as well put him away because we're saving the city trouble. So there was this real antagonism between—
Was it ever articulated by Wade or others, or was it just sort of a generally assumed posture?
It was generally assumed, but Wade tried to get blacks off juries, for example. He actually was struck down by the Supreme Court for trying to get blacks off juries. So it was a very, very racist era.
Mm. Barb, the other sort of factor in this is also class. You mentioned that the Young family was friends with Ross Perot, who at the time was really powerful. So not only was it a question of racial dynamics, but they were richer. They had more power in the criminal justice system. Given all that, are you surprised that the Young family hasn't in any way cooperated with the sort of reinvestigation into Spencer's guilt or lack thereof?
Yeah, that's a really hard question. I mean, I think what's going on with the Young family is that they want closure. I mean, I've talked to them many times, the sons many times, and what they say is, look, two juries convicted Ben Spencer back in 87 and 88 because he got a retrial. And, you know, those juries heard all of the best evidence and, you know, they got it right. And their view is, gee, people changed their... They changed their testimony later. They changed their accounts later. You know, the jury foreman, who believed they made a big mistake, he had kind of buyer's remorse. He feels guilty. So what they say is, you know, they got it right the first time, and we trust the legal system. And so far, the Court of Criminal Appeals and the district attorney have agreed with them.
They have no doubts that you can see?
I can't see any doubts.
Do you believe that they have no doubts?
I think they're beginning to wonder about all the evidence falling apart.
And it's a hard thing. I mean, I think that the question of what their mind tells them about everything that they've heard and how they grapple with their experience is probably we can't see inside of that. But I imagine that, I mean, our brains are, among other things, they are rationalizing machines.
Right.
Well, also, I mean, just imagine the pain and the anguish that they've gone through. And then to have the chapter reopened and to somehow be almost implicated in this crooked, if it is crooked, processing of a man and the throwing away of decades of his life is just adding trauma on top of what is a horrible, horrible thing to befall a family.
Yes. And I think one thing that they really object to is they say this story has always been couched. And I don't think we did it. But the story is usually couched as, you know, the wealthy, young, white professional family versus the poor blacks, the guy in the BMW versus, you know, the poor blacks. And I don't think that's actually the story, because we're not implicating blacks who shouldn't be implicated when it's actually a white. You know, we're not doing that, because the other much more viable suspect in many people's mind is a black man, right? So right. This isn't really a racial issue, but they felt that it has been tinged with race and wealth and prominence. And
well,
I think that bothers
me. I mean, it is a racial issue in the sense, I'm not talking about the young family. And obviously
the criminal justice system.
They lost a family member. It's horrifying. And to understand their psychological processes, that's another subject entirely. But it is a racial issue, because I just find it hard to believe that in Texas, a white middle class person certainly would be treated as, well, if he didn't do this, he did something else.
Right.
Maybe I'm being naive about it, but I just think that there is a double standard that we're talking about.
And there is. And what you see it kind of in the sentencing. So a black man who killed a white man got the death penalty, but a white man who killed a black man wouldn't. So there was always disparity there.
Yeah, and that persists.
Well, and just to put a finer point on it, you mentioned this and the proliferation of plea bargains in terms of getting felony convictions. And this is a sort of institutionalized system whereby especially black Americans, whether guilty or not, are made to enter into plea bargains just so they don't serve extended jail sentences. I mean, 94% of felony convictions at the state level are the result of a plea bargain, and 97% at the federal level. And those are staggering figures, and they are what people of color have come to expect. Innocence has nothing to do with it.
Yeah, and one of the alternate paths that this story might have taken is that back in 1988, before his retrial, Benjamin Spencer could have accepted a plea bargain.
Absolutely.
Could have said, regardless of the truth, that he was guilty. And he might have been out years before now.
He might have.
In that scenario.
And he said, and of course he said, no, I'm not going to plead guilty to something I didn't do. He was also a man of kind of great faith. And so he thought, the truth will set me free. But the other reason he didn't want to do it is he said, look, if I plead guilty to this and I'm out in 5 years, I'm still going to have a target on my back. Every time some crime occurs, the police would look at him and say, gosh, we railroaded Spencer once, we're going to do it again, and that he would always be their prime suspect.
If he actually admitted guilt, do you think he would get out the very next year?
He would have
expressed remorse, whether he felt it or not, for all the obvious reasons.
You mean now?
Yeah, now. Now. Like, if he actually went in front of the parole board and said, you know what, I did it, I feel terrible, I'm sorry, I've done 30 years, please let me out. You think he'd get out?
I don't think he would, and I'll tell you why.
Okay.
Because the DA is opposing it. She wrote a letter saying he shouldn't get parole, and also the family opposes it. And those two are very, very powerful.
But remorse is a big factor when a parole board looks at these people, right?
It is, and most people get parole after 20 years. He's now been in for 31 years, but there apparently are very powerful, like the DA doesn't always intervene, and she has in this case. And the family doesn't always come forward and say, you know, he shouldn't get out. My dad didn't get parole. And so you have these very powerful people coming forward and saying, no, I don't think you should give him parole.
If the wrong person was imprisoned for the murder of Jeffrey Young, that error was also not costless. When I think about other alternate stories and other ways that this could have gone. If Michael Hubbard was in fact the person responsible for Jeffrey Young's murder, then if he had been in Spencer's place, then he would not have been out of prison to have brutally assaulted those people in Dallas those years later.
Absolutely. I mean, when you think about it, there are the – so Michael Hubbard gets out in 1992. Then the string of brutal robberies begins, 10 of them. Very much, very – the same MO as what happened to Jeffrey Young. And so 10 men, executives, are like beaten brutally. Some of them can't ever work again. If Michael Hubbard is the killer, not only has Jeffrey Young's family suffered, but 10 other families have suffered too, needlessly, if he had been convicted the first time, if he were the actual killer.
Hmm. As it pertains to the DNA piece of this, Barb, part of the problem here is there was not a lot of forensic evidence. Then there's, you know, bad DNA collection. Have we gotten better, and is it less likely that things like this happen in the future?
Oh, yeah. So back then, they didn't even know about DNA. The first DNA case in Texas was in 1989. So they didn't even know to collect for DNA. It just – people have kind of lucked out if Dallas happened to keep any biological evidence from cases long ago. They lucked out because there might be DNA there. Now what happens is police actually collect DNA evidence right away, right on the crime scene. So what that means is that the number of cases, the number of DNA exonerations is going to dwindle. In fact, this is a problem for the Innocence Project because what they have really based their exonerations on is DNA evidence. Well, as more and more of the people who had, you know, convictions back in the 70s, 80s, 90s, where they're now finding DNA, as more and more of these people get parole or die or whatever, you're going to have fewer and fewer DNA exonerations. And so what's going to happen is people are going to have to do, like the Innocence Project, they'll have to do kind of the gumshoe investigation that places like Centurion Ministries does right now.
Based on your reporting on this story and stories like this, what percentage of people who are in jail for felonies, in prison for felonies, do you think might be innocent?
So,
it's a huge question.
No,
I know,
it is. But, and I've actually tried to
but
get
it's
a, the answer.
The answer is frightening if it's one, obviously.
Right. I've got to beg, you know, ignorance on this point because I've asked a lot of experts about it. And what people say is, look, most cases don't have DNA. And what that means, most crime scenes don't have DNA. And what that means is that there are, and people say, tens of thousands of people who claim they are innocent, but there is no DNA in their case. And so there's no path forward.
So there was
for them.
A witness or an opposing witness, and that was they're convicted based on witnesses.
Right. And we know that DNA shows that, you know, witnesses lie, eyewitnesses don't see correctly, you know, they see identify the wrong person, forensics is faulty. We see all these problems, and it's brought out by DNA exonerations. Oh my gosh, all these people were wrong. But if you don't have DNA, then there's no one to say, oh my gosh, all these, you know, jailhouse informants and eyewitnesses and all of that, all these people were wrong if that DNA
has anybody ever tried to put a number on this question?
Well, I've talked to people who have tried to, and the figure I come up with is tens of thousands.
Hmm. Wow.
That's depressing. How do we fix that?
Well, here's the issue that, you know, in Ben Spencer's case, he's had all this huge investigation and he's had us look at all of this and still he is stuck, right? Because there's no DNA. Think of all those people who have no one looking at their case, who don't have pro bono lawyers looking at this, who don't have a major magazine looking at it. They don't have a chance.
Yeah.
So DNA seems to be this sort of key to Spencer's potential release, and yet there is no DNA. And yet the very sort of premise here that DNA is the be-all, end-all is a fundamentally political belief, is it not?
That's true, or it serves political purposes. I mean, I think DNA is the best forensic tool that we have. It's just – it is a revolution. It's called a revolution for a reason. However, it has become a kind of a thorn in people's side because DNA has so increased the expectations that it's really hard to exonerate anyone without DNA. DNA gives political cover to the judges and to the district attorneys because if it turns out that, you know, it's Michael Hubbard and not Ben Spencer, then everyone can throw up their hands and say, oh my gosh, the DNA points to Michael Hubbard and not Ben Spencer. Of course we're going to let Ben Spencer out. But if there's no DNA, then the district district attorney and the judges, all of whom are elected, by the way, they can just kind of slide away from the issue because they don't want to be looked at as soft on crime. They don't want it to come back and haunt them and be used in political ads that, oh, gosh, you know, this judge voted to let a murderer out of prison. So what's happened with DNA is it's raised the expectations and it's politicized the process.
To go back to the point about plea bargains for a moment, last year, Emily Yaffe did a story for us, which we titled Innocence is Irrelevant, about the plea bargain. And one of the implications of cases like Spencer's is his is the scenario that prosecutors threaten defenders with every day. They say, you know, listen, you can let this go to a jury trial, and who knows what may happen. You may be in prison, as Spencer has been, for most of your life. Or you can take a plea, guilty or not. It's a more surefire thing. We will tell you with a strong degree of confidence how long you're going to spend in prison. So in a perverse way, Spencer's case itself feeds into the broader problem. I mean, if you were faced with that choice where someone was presenting you with a surefire sentence that certainly is longer than you may feel you deserve, but still shorter than most of your life.
Right, right. That's a really great point. And there's something else that's interesting about this case. I've thought about this a lot. You can look at all of the players and say that there are no bad guys. No one is to blame. So you look at the detectives and they say, and you say, well, they followed the best leads they have. You look at the district attorney, the prosecutors, and you say, well, they built their case on the detective's work. You look at the jury and they say, you say, well, okay, they came to their decision based on the evidence that was presented to them. You look at the DA afterwards and you say, well, okay, she doesn't want to, or they don't want to kind of revisit this case because there's no DNA evidence in it. You look at the Court of Criminal Appeals. Oh, he didn't meet the Herculean burden, which is essentially DNA evidence to prove he's actually innocent. What you have here is a process where everything can be perfectly done. The procedures can all be followed perfectly. And yet, at the end of the day, you may have an innocent man in prison for the rest of his life.
But this entire edifice is built, the entire edifice you described is built on the testimony of a person who could be the villain, right?
That's
the
right.
Woman who says she saw something that science tells us couldn't be seen.
Right, right. And I've thought about Gladys Oliver as well. And, you know, the only thing I can say, we don't know exactly what's in her mind right now, and we can't get at it because it's too foggy, right? But the one thing you could say is she did see Ben Spencer earlier in the evening, and maybe she conflated, you know, the times. You don't know. Although Jimmy Cotton's assertion that she orchestrated everything again, you know, to point toward Ben Spencer, that's pretty damning, in my opinion. Hmm. So maybe there is one person. To
yeah,
blame.
And looking at people acting, yeah, in terms of malice, that seems fairly malicious.
Yeah, there may not be clear villains, but there are folks who might not be thinking as much about the consequences of their actions, such as in this case, possibly the police.
Yes, yes. Detective Briseno, Jesse Briseno, he had a number of leads that he just never pursued, including Michael Hubbard. He was told about Michael Hubbard less than a month after the murder of Jeffrey Young. So he just made choices to believe some people and not believe other people, and the only people he believed were those who pointed toward Ben Spencer's guilt, and the only people he didn't believe were those who pointed away from it. So I think and it's not like this was last-minute breaking news for him right before the trial. You know, Michael Hubbard's name comes up. No, he had the name less than a month after the murder. So I think there is a bit of at least laziness or tunnel vision here.
What did he say about that omission? We heard a little bit from him about, you know, that you believe some witnesses lie, what have you.
Right.
But what did he say about the things that he did not put in front of that jury?
Well, so he didn't really want us to talk at all, right? It was like pulling teeth getting him to say anything. This was a case that he is – that haunts him, basically, and not in a good way. It's like it always comes back to bite him. And so basically all he would say is, you know what? People change their story. the best testimony is right after, he implied, the best testimony is right after the killing, you know, that when you get the witnesses right away, that's the best testimony. And he said, you know what, if people say that you know, we fed them information, which a number of people did, that we fed them Ben Spencer's name, well, they're just lying. You know, they're just lying. And he didn't really want to talk very much about it, to tell you the truth.
Hmm. Barb, Ben Spencer has a son, right?
That's right.
A son who he almost raised, who grew up, who met his father on the other side of prison plexiglass.
That's correct. Right.
What is that relationship now, and to what degree has his son taken up this fight?
So that's the hardest thing for Ben Spencer, is not being able to be in his son's life. They have a cordial relationship, but not a really strong one, because Ben Spencer hasn't been there for him during all the kind of turning points of one's life. Now this man is 31 years old, or just about 31 years old. You know, he has a fine relationship with his dad, but it's not close. And he has not really taken up the fight. The person who's taken up the fight the most is Ben Spencer's ex-wife, Deborah, who has remained loyal to him, even though she divorced him. He urged her to divorce him because he didn't want her life to be ruined by his incarceration. But she has remained loyal to him the entire time. And but the great sadness for him is that he hasn't been able to be part of his son's life.
You've spent plenty of time with Ben Spencer himself at this point. And both he and Jim McCloskey have been men of faith. How has this experience, and how does Spencer's, the prospect of him spending more of his life in prison, how has that adjusted his faith?
Yeah, it's really hard. I mean, I think he is dispirited, especially after the 2011 denial of a new trial. And what he says is, you know what, the truth may not have set me free, which is something that he was hoping, but the truth has been spoken. That's what he says, that the judge, you know, the judge found me innocent and that I deserved a new trial. Most people think that I am innocent. The truth has been spoken. And so he kind of has to cling to this idea that you know, he's been vindicated in some way. Jim McCloskey is also interesting. He was a seminarian 40 years ago, and now he's gotten freed 61 people off of death row and life sentences and all of that. Hundreds of years, wasted years of lives, right? Like, those 61 people represent hundreds of years of wrongful incarceration. And what Jim says is, he thinks, you know, what is the redeeming purpose of all of that waste? What is the redeeming purpose here? And what he has come to is this notion that C.S. Lewis talks about a bent but not broken faith. That, you know, you put one foot in front of the other. Gosh, my faith is a little bit tarnished. Gosh, you know, there's a story in the gospel where a man comes to Jesus and says, please heal my son, you know, if you can. And Jesus says, what do you mean, if I can? And the guy goes, Lord, I believe. Help me with my unbelief. And what Jim says is, 40 years ago when I was a seminarian, I could say, Lord, I believe. Now, after all these years of seeing all this tragedy and all these wrongful convictions, all I can say is, Lord, I believe, but help me with my unbelief.
Mm. So, Barb, this is a story that you've said has stuck with many of the people who've been involved in it. And now I imagine it has stuck with our listeners for good or ill. But thank you for telling it.
Well, thank you for giving me the chance to spend so much time and telling the story. It's been amazing.
It's remarkable. It's really one of the most moving and interesting stories we've ever told at The Atlantic. So thank you for doing it.
Well, thank you.
Barb, you said that you wake up in a cold sweat. There's no one that listens to the series here, parts 1, 2, and 3, and does not come away with a bruise on his or her conscience about how we can do this to American citizens, to men and women who are part of the fabric of this country, to wrongly potentially incarcerate them for life. It's staggering.
Yeah. Once again, no keepers this week, but I think we've just heard quite a bit to keep. Barb, thank you again.
Thank you.
Jeff, Alex, till next time.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Before we end the series and roll the credits, a footnote. We received a letter from a fellow inmate of Benjamin Spencer's, and we thought it was worth sharing part of that letter with you. Again, we can't say whether Spencer is innocent or guilty, so the thoughts in this letter represent only the perspective of its writer, a man named John Adams. He says, quote, "I spent 12 years at the H.H. Cofield unit with Spencer, and I'll never forget the first time I saw him. Another prisoner pointed him out. That's Spencer, the barber. He's innocent." An outsider wouldn't understand how extraordinary those words were. Among inmates, a guy claiming innocence is such a bloated cliché, it's beneath contempt. We all know there are countless innocent men inside, yet it's still a surprise when someone we've known for years gets exonerated. Even after my 21 years of incarceration, Spencer remains the only one I've ever known to be exempt from this general skepticism. That in itself speaks volumes about Spencer. I understand that Ms. Haggerty's focus in her splendid article was the obstacles facing Spencer and other likely innocents in their quest for post-conviction justice, but I wish she had written more about why innocent people get convicted in the first place. Former Attorney General Janet Reno summed it up pretty aptly when she said that justice is available only to those who can afford lawyers. Like hundreds of thousands of other Americans, Spencer was stuck with an overworked court-appointed defense attorney who had little chance or incentive to interview eyewitnesses in depth, check credibility, and find motives for lying. Court-appointed attorneys also lack the time and resources to uncover facts that tunnel-vision police ignore and win-motivated prosecutors withhold, and many lack the showmanship necessary to inspire juries. Jury trials are not as objective as the ideal. People have always relied more on emotion than on logic in deciding what to believe. Frankly, Spencer is merely a statistic, one of thousands of innocent victims trapped in a state-sponsored nightmare for no crime other than being poor. This series, No Way Out, was reported by Barbara Bradley Haggerty over a period of months, produced by Kevin Townsend, and edited by Libby Lewis, Kevin Townsend, and myself, Matt Thompson. No Way Out is adapted from a story that first ran in the January-February 2018 issue of The Atlantic. That story was edited by John Swansburg and Denise Wills, with additional editing and fact-checking from Scott Stossel, Yvonne Rolshausen, Ellie Smith, Janice Woolley, Karen Ostergren, Jake Pellini, Katie Daniels, and Eli Lee. The theme song of Radio Atlantic is John Batiste's exemplary rendition of the Battle Hymn of the Republic. We very much want to know your thoughts and questions after listening to this story, so please leave us a voicemail with your contact information at 202-266-7600. You can find this show at facebook.com/radioatlantic and theatlantic.com/radio. In the episode description, you'll find a link to extensive show notes and the original magazine story online. We very much appreciate it when our listeners rate and review us in Apple Podcasts and subscribe in their preferred podcast app. But we appreciate you all for listening. May you find truth and may you find freedom in it. Till next time.